statements and opinions by guests of Mysterious Radio are not to be considered as endorsed by sponsors or affiliated networks. Any rebroadcast, reproduction, or other use of this podcast without the express written consent of Mysterious Radio is strictly prohibited.
Get ready for a night filled with conspiracies, strange places, the paranormal, UFOs, legends, and myths from around the world. With your hosts, K-Town, on Mysterious Radio.
I have a great show for you tonight with my special guest, author Gary Wayne. And he's here to discuss his book, The Genesis 6 Conspiracy, How Secret Societies and the Descendants of Giants Plan to Enslave Humankind. This book is impressive. When you see it, you're going to be in awe. And I am thoroughly impressed at how much he's been able to actually put into this book. And I could really have a show based on all the things that Gary has in this book for a solid year, probably more. And you can easily pick up your copy of the Genesis 6 Conspiracy from Amazon.com. So tonight our focus is going to be on the royal bloodlines of these powerful families that control the planet. And I can't wait for this. So let's bring him out. All right, my special guest tonight is author Gary Wayne, and he's going to be discussing his amazing book called The Genesis 6 Conspiracy, How Secret Societies and the Descendants of Giants Plan to Enslave Humankind. I highly recommend you pick up this book on Amazon.com. Gary, I want to thank you very much for joining me tonight on Mysterious Radio.
Well, so happy to be here and very much looking forward to conversation we're going to have, and I think the audience is going to at least have their curiosity raised by the time we're done.
Oh, absolutely. And I'll tell you what, first, I really appreciate your time to come on this show and discuss parts of your research for my listeners. This is a huge book, and you can tell that you definitely took a great deal of time to put all this information together to give people a better understanding of what's really happening and how it all ties together. So I want you to tell us a bit more about yourself and when you realized that this ultimate plan for enslavement was at play.
Yeah, that's a good question. And I kind of backed my way into writing this book. And I wanted to write my first book, and I wanted to write a short book just to sort of test my craft and see whether I could get published and could make sense of a story. And it turned out probably going to be the longest book I ever wrote, and I also weeded out, you know, over 300 pages to get it down to a size that it could be published. So how I came about it was, is I kind of backed into it through prophecy and my passion for prophecy, which matches up with my other passions for mythology and for history. And so as I cataloged all of the various prophetic narratives that are in the Bible, I kept coming across these references that are, you know, from the real supernatural part of the Bible. So Genesis 6, you have giants, and after the flood, you have giants, and you have talk of angels, and you have talk of demons, and you have the abyss in Revelation, and you have demons coming out of the king's mouths in Revelations. And so I wanted just to sort of connect Genesis 6 with the end time and write a short book. But so to speak, you know, on the path to the Colosseum is I got diverted down the rabbit holes, and how that came about was I decided to add not just, you know, talk about the biblical aspect of it. I decided to add my knowledge of mythology and history to it. And as I was doing that and showing how it tells a similar story all around the world, both before and right after the flood, and even into the end time in many cases, I started knocking up against the door of the secret societies. And so once I started to investigate that, then I really went down the rabbit hole. And that's where it became more of the conspiracy aspect, because what you learn as you dig deep into this is that there's two clear forces that are you know, at work here. And depending on which side you're on is the one that you're going to decide that is either good or evil. I come from things from a Christian bias by my choice. And so they are talking about the same things in the past. They're talking about the same things today, and they're talking about the same things in the future, just from different perspectives. And when it got combined with understanding that these forces came together before the flood. And what I mean by that is that if you trace the history of the secret societies, they are formed out of something called the seven sacred sciences that is added to by fallen angels, which is the illicit knowledge from heaven. So it kind of puts this knowledge on steroids. And this knowledge, according to secret societies, was taught to Adam in Eden. And then afterwards, after he is ostracized with Eve outside of Eden, he teaches this knowledge to Cain and to Abel. Abel is killed by Cain, and then later Adam will teach it to Seth. So now you have the teaching of this knowledge that was learned by Adam. This is according to secret societies and Gnostics. In Eden, and they're going to develop it in two different ways. And Cain teaches this to his first son, Enoch, as opposed to the Enoch from the Seth line, which is the son of Jared, who was taken to heaven. So there's two Enochs people have to keep in mind here. And so Enoch develops this into the seven sacred sciences, this knowledge, and he organizes it and he develops it. And he develops the mystical religions to house this from, an initiation, and he develops the religion of sun worship, which is mysticism. And he develops the secret societies to develop specific aspects of these sciences, like geometry is the fifth science. With masonry, we call it masonry within the craft. And so they take their patriarch back to Enoch and Cain. I'm talking about secret societies when I say they. And they also have other great patriarchs like in the craft that they talk about in their legends and their history, like Tubal-Cain and Nama and Lamech. And these are all from the Cain line. And so this partners with the descendants of Cain, the knowledge, the fallen angels. They will partner in Genesis 6 to create another race called the Nephilim, from the offspring of fallen angels and human females. And then they partner to take over the antediluvian world. So you have this mystical polytheist religion partnered with Nephilim giants who have usurped all of the different civilizations around the world, and it brings about the flood. And all of this is about to bring about the demise of humankind. And this conspiracy, these organizations, these descendants, these belief systems, these secret societies crossed the flood and have been waging a war to do so ever since.
All right. Now, you talk about secret societies, and that's something I do want to touch on tonight. You talk about so many aspects of this plan, going all the way back through history, and looking at the titles, just the titles of your chapter, I couldn't help but think about Hollywood movies that have already been made talking about these same events from the past. And I'm wondering what you think about movies being used to influence our thoughts about our history and manipulating us for future events.
Most of the ideas that come about, certainly in the fantasy realm and in the science fiction realm, in the horror realm, in the fairy tale realm, those are all stories that are based on the belief systems and characters and what happened in the antediluvian age for the most part. So if you understand the allegories and the characters from the past, you can understand where all of these different ideas sort of come from. So superheroes would be kind of, you know, the classic case, right? Where you have a superhero, like let's say Superman. And Superman is, he's got this fancy S on it with an inverted, almost pyramid-like symbol. And that S looks like a snake. And he is a Kal-El, son of Jor-El, and El is Hebrew for angel or God. And so he's a son of God, or as it's put in Genesis 6, you know, one of the sons of God that procreates with human females to create these Nephilim. And his father is El, and El is also the god of the pantheon in Canaan. And so these figures are all based on that. And if you understand that these watchers that were the ones who procreated with human females were the seraphim watchers, you quickly understand that that goes back to fiery serpent. And these are dragon-like looking angels that rebelled. And that's where the dragon imagery from a heavenly perspective comes from, as opposed to the physical animals of this world. And the mythology around dragons that are sort of physical animals, but they had the face of a serpent, and the Nephilim took on that look in their first generation. So you can see where some of this imagery and allegory is going to be overlaid, just as, you know, there's that movie out that's The Shape of Water that took a lot of awards at the Oscars, as I understand it. And that's based on the Oannes, who I will talk about in my book, gods that came out of the water to develop the Sumerian religion and provide knowledge and writing and civilization and mate with humans to create, again, this hybrid race. So again, you have the similar story that's going on in Genesis, but that whole story is kind of reflecting that whole ideology. And if you understand that going into the movie, you can watch it with entertainment, but not be deceived by the messages that they're trying to make throughout the entertainment.
Exactly. All right. I would love to talk about the royal bloodline. So can you give us some history about them and what families make up that bloodline?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it is a significant part about what I write about in the book. So the Nephilim bloodline that I've been speaking about, which are the offspring of the fallen angels, as I mentioned, in the antediluvian world, they usurped the kingships of the world and set up their dynasties. After the flood, this happens again. And these become the great royal dynasties of the world. So it starts off, as we understand it from a Western perspective, in the Mesopotamian region, in the Middle East region. So when we're talking about what we would know from Mesopotamia, it would be Nimrod, and Nimrod would be marrying into this other race's bloodline as they usurp those kingships again. And so Nimrod is sort of drafted in terms of the occult understanding of what happens, not the biblical understanding. And so they produce these great empires, and we would know them as Egypt, and we would know them, you know, as Assyria, we would know them as Babylon and Persia. And these are the dynasties that are going to produce the end time dynasties. So as when we take a step back and we understand that these dynasties keep track of their genealogies all the way back into the mists of time and continue to intermarry to keep their bloodlines as pure as possible. So whether or not it's the Mitanni dynasty that is in the Kassite dynasty that's going to send daughters over to Amenhotep III, which is going to produce Akhenaten, this idea of royal families intermarrying is an ancient concept that happens even to this day. So if we roll that forward just as a sort of quick example, you know, the start of World War I was basically a in-house family war. So you have like the Romanovs, who are the czars of Russia, are the cousins, the Kaisers of Germany, who are cousins to the Windsors in London, who are cousins to the Habsburgs, who are cousins to the King of Spain, and on and on and on, because they kept intermarrying to keep those bloodlines pure. And so this has been a concept that has happened all the way through history. Now, not all of these families are controlling what we would call visible power on a visible throne today. Obviously, a lot of them have disappeared off the throne. But that doesn't mean that they're not still active and not working together to work things behind the scenes, which is kind of their connection to the secret societies. And so this is not just a Western phenomena, and I'll come back to the Western idea understanding of bloodlines, but this goes right around the world. So if you have, let's say in the Chinese tradition, you have the same sort of prehistory going on with, instead of being called seraphim angels, they're called dragons. And you have the heavenly gods that are creating Earth, and they create the Shah family, or the Shah race, that is going to produce all of the dynastic Chinese kings as they come down to the time of communism. And the royal family that comes down through those lines is the Li family. And of course, today you now have Li Pan back on the throne, basically, because he's just been in the process of going to be president for life of China, of getting that back. And the Li family is very, very powerful amongst the Chinese mafia, Chinese corporations. It's just one of those bloodlines that are just right in your face. People just don't realize it because they don't know what the Chinese history is. And just as you have the Yamamoto dynasty out of Japan, but that also links back to the Li dynasty, you have when the Spanish came over to North America, everybody thinks that all of the bloodlines of the kings were wiped out. It was just the immediate king. And by the mid-1500s or shortly before, the Spanish had re-established the nobility status of all of the surviving royal families that survive to this day. So these bloodlines are not just a North American phenomena. And again, you would have out of India, you have the Khan family and the Singh bloodline, which are two prominent ones coming out of a very, very long and entangled history in Japan. And then you have these, the families that are forming the royal dynasties in Europe, which is probably where most of your listeners want me to go to. But I wanted to give a background that this is not just a Western sort of idea. This is something that's known around the world. So before I start moving forward on that, did you have any questions or anything you wanted to add on that before
yes.
I move on?
Yes. Gary, how many families make it up, first of all?
Well, again, the number 13 is the number that people like to banty about. I'm not necessarily convinced that it's a number of 13 because there's many, 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 many branches. But the standard number, you know, right at the top that will control the secret societies are the 13 families. But the 13 families don't tend to be the families that most people want them to be.
Okay.
So the first thing people need to remember about all of this is that they're like puppeteers in behind the scenes for the most part. Now, the Windsors are very obviously a visible one because they're still on the throne. But if, for the most part, if we see a visible family, they are not the purebloods. They are married in, they are working for them, but they are not the purebloods. And Rothschilds would be a classic example of them as part of the banking arm of the secret societies that needed to be formed after the fall of the Templars. But they married into the line. They were relatively unknown, and they were known as the Bauer family in Germany before they combined with the secret societies and formed the banking arm to replace the Templars. And they didn't change their name to Rothschild until they opened up their London bank in 1812. So the Rothschilds are very important, but they're not the real power. And so when people look at the Rockefellers or any of the American families, those are the pseudo blue bloods. And they're not, they are intermarried and they're ennobling as they go throughout the generations, but they are not the families that people should be focusing on in terms of the pure bloods. And the reason why I want to make this connection so that people can understand what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the pure bloods and the bloodlines and the secret societies. If you understand that Freemasonry is an important organization, but it's more of one that brings new recruits into mysticism. And as they go up the ziggurat of knowledge, they become an adept. And from there, they go into the Illuminati, and then they go into the Rosicrucians, and pretty much everything else funnels into the Rosicrucians or underneath as you go up that charter. And then above the Rosicrucians, Rosicrucians, you start to really get into the purebloods. But in the Rosicrucians, you have about half the members that are the purebloods. So Rosicrucians will go to, you know, the council, the committee of 300 and the council of 33, and then to the 13 families, kind of rough and dirty on how that whole thing comes together. And the purebloods are the royal bloodlines who keep their genealogies and can prove their pedigree that go right back to the Nephilim. And that includes, let's say, the Swedish royal family that would take their bloodlines back to the Norse gods. And Rollo would be one of those significant families that are part of these purebloods, but you don't know them as Rollo. And Rollo is the ancestor of William the Conqueror, who becomes King of England in 1066. But when Rollo invades France, he takes the Normandy section and signs a contract that basically has the name St. Clair attached to it. So they adopt that name of St. Clair, which is going to be transliterated into Sinclair when they move into Scotland. And of course, Sinclairs are the founders of Freemasonry. So St. Clair is one of those family names that you need to keep in mind. And there's some branches of the St. Clair bloodline. You have like St. Clair de Geyser. And Geyser is a very, very important name, and its castle is right next to Normandy. And this is where the cutting of the elms took place, where the Priory of Sion splits away from the Templars because they feel the Templars have lost Jerusalem and lost their way and have become greedy. And so they move away from the organization. They set up the Rosicrucians, and they are actually part of the first Grand Masters of the Priory of Sion as it comes down through history. Even though they're a part of the Templars, you could actually say that their Grand Masters would go right back to the creation of the Templars in about 1090 to 1099. So Geyser is another one of these families. And do you want me just go into some of these more important names
and then we can talk
about them?
Yes, okay. Yes, please.
So I led in with the St. Clairs, and St. Clair is not listed amongst one of the founders of the Knights Templars, but he is a battling partner of Hugh de Payen, who is acknowledged as one of them. And only in the Rex Du and the St. Clair books, and that's where I got the reference from, is from St. Clair history, that they were part of the knights that went to establish the Templar order in Jerusalem at the Priory of Sion on a rock and a small temple in Jerusalem. And so de Payen is one of these members, as St. Clair is, as a start of the Templars. But what people don't understand is that these weren't poor knights. These weren't monks. These were sons of the royal bloodlines of England and France. These are the most powerful bloodlines and the kings that are forming this organization. And so de Payen and de Bouillon are the two main sort of progenitors of this organization, and Anjou. And I'll touch on Anjou in a second. But Anjou, de Payen, de Bouillon, they come from the Lorraine region as ruling those areas. And so these three will take their bloodlines back, and I won't go back further on this until we talk about these other families, and we'll see how the time goes. But they are taking their bloodline back into history as the last survivor of the Merovingian bloodline when they're overthrown by the Catholic Church, and this person is Dagobert. And so they take their bloodline back there. So de Bouillon is a significant name that's still part in the background, just as de Payen is and just as Anjou is. And in 1118, I just want to make one more connection here with these three, is that in a small temple at this priory in Zion is Baldwin, who is de Bouillon's brother, is crowned king of Jerusalem in that temple. And then it's later picked up by Anjou, who picks it up after Baldwin dies. And the reason why Jerusalem is important is because they also have Sion or grafted in Benjamite bloodlines from King Saul. And of course, Jerusalem was given to the Benjamites by Joshua at the time of the Exodus. And so roll that forward, you have the King of Jerusalem title coming down into the Habsburgs and into the current King of Spain, King Philippe. And this is the title that they say they want to claim as Antichrist in the temple in Jerusalem in the end time. So Anjou produces a name that most people, I think, in North America might be familiar with, called Plantagenet. And the Plantagenet is the family that all the presidents up to the time before Obama, and I don't know about Trump, and I didn't see Obama's bloodline going back to the Plantagenet, but all the other American presidents go back to the Plantagenet, which is King John Plantagenet, who signed the Magna Carta. And so this is the same bloodline that the leaders of the United States, for the most part, have been attaching their bloodline to. So, and I don't have any research on Obama, and I didn't really spend any time on it that direction. But the thought is that his bloodline would go back somehow through Egypt and through a different bloodline, right?
Right.
But still part of the whole sort of that global concept I had talked about earlier.
So, Gary, would there be something, let me just ask you this while I'm thinking about it, would there be something in their DNA that would say that they belong to this? Because the reason why I'm asking is because I've read that these people have a high percentage of reptilian DNA. What do you think about that?
Well, they say they do. They don't call it reptilian DNA. They have more euphemistic terms for it. So, it comes about in a couple of different manners. So the first one would be that people might understand is that it's called the spark of the divine, as the Gnostics like to call it. And the spark of the divine is what they want to bring together when they have world government so that they can evolve into God. So this is the 1,000 points of light that the Bushes would talk about in some of their occultic speeches. And so how they arrive at that is that they believe in something called the gene of Isis. And that is also the root word in the occult for Genesis. And this is the gene that comes from the offspring of the God. So they believe there are DNA markers, and it's why I believe that they are doing so much research on DNA and DNA banking so that they can identify all of those who have that DNA that they would offer into the new millennium or the new Reich, as some people like to call it in the occult, that is going to be promised by Antichrist to. And if you don't have that, then you're not going to be offered the new age because you're just mundane. You're only good for slaughter, for ritual sacrifice, and for slavery. The other aspect that comes down is the Rosicrucian ideology that is called the Vril concept. And if people don't know what the Vril, V-R, that's V as in Victor, R-I-L concept is, it is something in the blood that comes down the bloodlines that if they could de-engineer it, they could recreate the super race of giants that were in the past. And this real concept is the same concept that the Nazis overlaid with their Volkisch ideology to develop the new man or the Superman or the Nephilim concept that they were trying to engineer that was blonde-haired and blue-eyed. So this real concept in the blood is a very real concept that they think that was going to be a big part of it. And they believe that that bloodline is the negative Rh negative bloodline. And so, again, it's one of the reasons why they like to have the knowledge on the blood and the blood banks is because they want to know who's got the bloodline as well. And there's only 15% of the population that has Rh negative blood. And so when you talk about, let's say, again, because most people will recognize, you know, the Windsor family, is their Rh negative is O negative in the bloodline. And this bloodline gets more condensed as you get, or more populated and condensed amongst people as you move into France. And in France, you'll get, you know, 25 to 35% that is OH negative, because that's where more of the concentration of the bloodlines that migrated out of Europe concentrated. And then when you move into an area called Spain, there's a people called and depending on how you want to pronounce it, Basque or Baziki, they believe they are what they call Homo Atlantis, believe it or not, and that they are the original founders of civilization after the flood. And they settled in Spain, and they started the Egyptian after the flood civilization, the Scythian civilization, and the Mesopotamian civilization. And they believe they have a superior pedigree to the bloodlines that came down from the metallic dynasties out of the Middle East. And so they had this bit of a battle, and these other bloodlines and blood families of the ones that I was just talking about earlier basically had them dispersed in a diaspora around the world. They call that the Basque diaspora. But their concentrations are as high as 80%.
Oh, my. Oh, goodness. Oh, this is amazing. I love hearing all about this. All right. I'm talking to author Gary Wayne about his book, The Genesis 6 Conspiracy, How Secret Societies and the Descendants of Giants Plan to Enslave Humankind. And we have more for you when we return right after this. All right, we are back. And now, Gary, let me just stop you for just a moment and let's talk about some particulars about the royal family. I did read that they were each given an area of the planet to control, the global finances, military technology development, things like that. Tell us more about that, or if you agree with that.
Well, I think they all have, yeah, their own sort of jurisdictions. And This is, again, sort of that ancient sort of concept where there are these different civilizations and you have these spheres of influence. And they answer to the god of that sort of region, which is, you know, one of the watchers or the governors of the earth, as they were known before the flood. So it makes sense that that type of system would be here all the way through, whether or not we see it visibly or not. But it's interesting when we get into prophecy again is that we're going to have these 10 empires of the end time that are around the world. And these are spheres of influences or groups of nations or trading blocks, however you want to describe it. But they are distinct areas of responsibility. And the secret societies that are run by the purebloods, they all have specific agendas and goals, just as the Rothschilds were the banking arm. That's what they do, right? And you have, you know, the Freemasons, and their specific goal is an agenda other than, you know, trying to work towards world government is to focus on politics and the military, and they now overlap more into the media. So each of these groups, whether it's the Rosicrucians or it's the Royal College or it's the Jesuits that were all formed to replace the Templars, all have their specific agenda. So this would also apply in that sort of overall organizational structure to the royal families.
Okay. Now, Gary, is there one family that is, you know, kind of the hierarchy over the rest of them?
Well, it's there is and there isn't. So I would say that they all want to be one, as in that sort of that old Highlander series, which is, again, based on these ancient Nephilim. There can only be one. But there are more ennobled of the bloodlines. And certainly the Anjou, Plantagenet are ones to be to watch. But you also have the Stuart family, and they come out of the Plantagenet, and they actually formed and joined so many different aspects of the royal families that they were thought to be the most ennobled bloodline of that time, just as the Merovingians were the most ennobled before that. But then they funneled some other bloodlines as they go down through history. So keep an eye on that the Stuart bloodline and the Plantagenet bloodline, because I think those are probably The more important ones today, although some people will say to me, Nana, you're still underestimating the Du Bullion, but, or this, and then the Sinclairs. But anyways, you've got the top four or five basically there. And the Habsburgs are just sort of part of this being intermarried in. And as I mentioned into a little earlier, is that De Payen, Anjou, and Du Bullion come out of the Lorraine area of France. And then this bloodline intermarried with the Habsburgs. And that's why it became known as the Habsburg-Lorraine dynasty. And another thing to keep an eye out on this bloodline of these, of the more pure ones, is they have this iconology that's called the double cross. So if you looked at an Oreo cookie, for example, you're going to see a cross that's got two crossbars on the standing up pillar. That's a heraldic sign of a secret bloodline that they take back into prehistory.
Okay. Now, let's talk about this. I'm going to go back because you were talking about this forbidden information or sign. You're talking about the seven sciences, and I did read part of that in your book. But some of this forbidden knowledge, are they accessing this knowledge from fallen angels today through quantum technology?
Oh, I think so. I think so. And you know, a lot of people think that, you know, the quantum technology and understanding and AI is all being sort of partnered at CERN to get access to the abyss. There's a lot of sort of speculation on that. But quantum mechanics, you know, you need that to work in different dimensions. And so the abyss is thought to be in a different dimension. Although in the Book of Enoch, it'll say it's in the earth. It's in the earth in like a different dimension, because dimensions are all around us. So one has to be careful in understanding what that means. And you need that quantum computing to be able to work in these different dimensions. But quantum computing today is sort of single focused, right? So it's very good at what it can do, and it can hold like 30 times the knowledge of what's in the universe in terms of the number of particles. But only one thing at a time. So they need AI to sort of match this up so that it can do more functions at the same time than just a single focus. And so quantum computing, I think, is going to play a significant role as we move into the end time, as it matches up with artificial intelligence and as this whole understanding of offering godhood is going to be uniquely attached to this. And again, all of this quantum computing, it goes back to, if you look at the scientists who are involved at the beginning, they will tell you, and even today, they will tell you that if you really want to understand quantum mechanics, is you need to understand the Vedas, the Upanishads, because it's about quantum entanglement. Everything that's being talked about in quantum computing, just as it talks about that in the Vedas. And I think they're looking for more than just trying to poke a hole into the abyss to get Abaddon out of it. That's recorded in Revelation 9. I think they're looking for what they call the Atman particle. That's A-T-M-A-N. And sometimes there's a H in there, and sometimes there's not an N on the end. But this is a particle that they're searching for, which some people sometimes misname as the God particle. And it holds the ability to have the universal knowledge, and understand occultism is a religion of knowledge and a cult of knowledge. And so they're trying to find this particle because they can't see it. It's kind of invisible, but in their belief system, it attaches to other particles. And in quantum entanglement, it sends that knowledge universe-wide instantaneously. And this is the knowledge that they're trying to access. So when they're using quantum mechanics today, they're taking it in a whole bunch of different directions, all that are key to bringing about the end time.
Oh, wow. All right. Let's talk about some of the more, and I don't know if you know this, I'm sure you do, though. Some of the more disturbing and unsettling things about what these families do to further their agenda. Can you share some of those with us, Gary?
They're trying to control everything to bring about world government and a universal religion. And so if you go there first to understand it, then you need to know that everything that's involved in politics, everything that's involved in money and business, everything that's involved in the media, everything that's involved in education, and everything that's involved in religion is being manipulated and controlled to cattle herd people into that direction, which is why you need to understand the relationship between secret societies and the royal families and the Templars. And so let me just break down some of these key organizations in terms of all the avenues that they're working on. So when the Templars fell, they wanted to make sure that this was not just all under one house like it was before. So you had the Rosicrucians being set up after 1188, and they're going to be sort of the key organization. And they're already organizing and doing things and bringing about the Sarkani Rond and Ordo Draconis, as they would call themselves, to put more of the dragon kingships back onto the throne in Europe because they were being pushed back. And that's in the early 1400s. And so they're very, very powerful by then. But they are the first organization, and they are to control the religious aspect of it and the history, the genealogies, and the mythologies. And so they are the ones who house Gnosticism and keep that alive, which is sort of this global putting together of religions. They father theosophy, which is going to be very important when you get into understanding what happened with the Nazis. Theosophy, although the Nazis called it Ariosophy. And it is also the parent to the New Age movement. So that's the Rosicrucians. The Freemasons, I already talked about in terms of the military, the media, and politics. And then you have the Illuminati, who was created to really focus on world government, but also to try and bring down Christianity as their primary sort of goal. And then you have the Royal Society that is put together by the Rosicrucians and the Freemasons. And what they're designed to do is to take control of science and education outside the Catholic Church to lead people away from God, to not give God the honor of anything for creating anything, and to honor their pantheon of gods. And so they control the education and the outside Catholic religious systems today that do the brainwashing and the preparation to bring about these globalist ideas, whether or not it's on the environment or whatever. These are all sort of from their sourcing. Then you have the Jesuits, who were created again in about the 1500s. And of course, two of the three founders are Basques or Bazikis that I was telling you about. And they interpret the religion through the seven sacred sciences, which is the founding of the secret societies in the beginning. And their job is to get control of the education within Roman Catholic Church, which they've done. They were at the edge of all the exploration into the New World and around the world during the Age of Exploration. And they're to get control of the Roman Church and turn it to a point where they can bring about through the Roman Church this universal religion. And then, of course, you have the Rothschilds and the banking that I talked about before. So those are the main sort of string pullers in all of those areas. And when you look at an organization that I think people need to be a little bit more familiar with, and there's tons of them, whether it's Skull and Bones and Bohemian Grove and things like that, there's one that's called the Club of Rome, which is really, really important. And they were formed in the late 60s, and they answer directly to the Rosicrucians. And Pierre Trudeau, for example, was Prime Minister of Canada when I was growing up, and he was part of this Club of Rome, and we used to see them on the CBC News, and then all of a sudden it just appeared after a while that they wouldn't show them going into those meetings. But they were formed in the 60s to separate the world into 10 blocks of nations, spheres of influence, trading blocks, what have you, in preparation for the end time. And they're the ones who created this idea, and maybe a lot of listeners won't like this, but these are their ideas in terms of how do you cattle herd people into it. They created the idea of overpopulation. They created global warming. And of course, back then, we were supposed to be going into an ice age until they decided to come out with the global warming. So overpopulation, global warming, and environmental issues, because all of these things, they just go beyond all the borders, and it sort of unites people under a global cause, so that eventually through scare tactics, they're going to say, we need to come together because and form a world government because we don't want to destroy ourselves from the sort of face of the earth. So
what about tactics to reduce the global population?
That's going to come. Right now, they're still in the process of getting sort of people used to the idea that there's too many of us. In the U.S., there's what most people think is a written record of what they plan to do called the Georgia Guidestones, where it wants to reduce the population to 500 million. And that's not the average human. That would be only the ones that they deem capable or in terms of evolving into gods or having the spark of the divine or having the bloodline or having the gene of Isis or whatever allegory that you'd want to use to be identified to take over the earth. But there is going to be a tipping point as this comes about. And I think it happens when you start to maybe have either by natural or contrived design, natural disasters, wars, famines and stuff that are going to say, hey, the world has to change, right? There has to be some sort of cataclysmic change or catalyst that's going to drive that point home, because the way we're going today is yes, the population grows, but technology continues to advance to feed more people. But they're going to want to bring this to a tipping point. So I'm looking for more of contrived catastrophes.
Right, because that's over 90% of the population. I mean, we've got 7 billion people right now. To get it down to 500 million, that's a lot of people gone.
Sure. You know what? And it's also why that they're trying to get people used to eating bugs.
Okay, right? Wait a minute. tell us more about that. What do you mean eating bugs?
Well, when you create these contrived categories or catastrophes, and there's going to be starvation in things, they want to hoard the good food for themselves. So that's why you see this push as being introduced that, you know, insects are good. They eat them all over the world. They're full of protein. There's unlimited numbers of them. You should eat, you know, June bugs or grasshoppers or whatever. They're getting us used to the idea so that they can hoard more limited resources for themselves.
Oh, goodness. All right.
Remember, they think that we're mundane, right? So we should eat bugs. Yeah.
Well, you know what? I want to say real quick, Gary, that the 500 million number has been uttered by presidents. And I did see a video on YouTube where Prince Charles said that as well. So it was a little unnerving there. Have you visited the Georgia Guidestones?
No, I haven't. One of the things that I would certainly like to do. But I think when you hear, and they do use this number more regularly than what people may think, when they end up using the same number, that comes from a single source or a single belief system. And that's why it's important, for people like yourselves to mention that, because it's not just this wild conspiracy belief. It's what these elites actually believe, and they tend to do what they talk about, and they want you to know beforehand before they do it.
Right. Gary, this has been an amazing conversation. I'm going to have you back to discuss the alien phenomenon, how it ties into this. So I hope you'll come back and share that with us. I want to give you an opportunity now to tell my listeners where they can find more information about you and your books.
Sure. The easiest way to get a hold of me is through my website, Genesis6Conspiracy.com. That's Genesis 6 with the number 6Conspiracy.com. On there, you'll get a generous excerpt of all 98 chapters in my book, so you can get a good feel for it. You can contact me through my website. You can also get a signed copy of my book from my website, or link into Kindle, or into BarnesandNoble.com, or into Amazon.com, or into Amazon.ca. If you want to purchase that way, you can purchase my book basically on most online bookstores. It is available through bookstores. It's distributed by Bookmaster. So if you wanted to distribute or to support your local bookstore, they can order it in for you if they don't have it on the shelf. If you're trying to get a hold of me or follow me through Facebook, I'm under Gary Wayne, and I put out a weekly blog out there, a weekly post that usually gets a lot of reaction with information that is not always in the book that I have. So some very interesting stuff there. And you can also follow me or get a hold of me through Twitter at GaryWayne63, at GaryWayne63. And if you have a question and you get and send it to me, I will get back to you on it.
All right. Very good. Gary, thank you so much. Many blessings to you. And of course, you're welcome back here anytime.
Well, thank you. I'd love to come back. And aliens is a fascinating subject, no doubt about it.
All right. That's going to do it for tonight's edition. I want to thank my special guest, Gary Wayne, again for joining me. You can pick up Gary's book, The Genesis 6 Conspiracy, on Amazon.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the show from whatever podcast app you're listening from. I want to thank my producer, Kim, and the Mysterious Radio team. I am your host, K-Town. Have a great night, and I will see you next time on Mysterious Radio.
Like the show? Get more Mysterious Radio on our website. And don't forget to visit our Twitter and Facebook page.